The opinions and views expressed in Dead Men Do Tell Tales and all affiliated media are Jordan and Nicole's and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of their training program or others working in the field of medico-legal death investigation.
Hey everyone.
Welcome to Dead Men Do Tell Tales,
a podcast about forensic pathology related topics.
I'm Nicole Kroom.
And I'm Jordan Taylor.
And we're both pathology residents who are going into forensic pathology.
And Cole is here and awake, so beware the thumps. Going from last week when we were doing animal attacks, we figured we would switch to something that kind of can be related to animal attacks, but is also its own separate category.
And is a little bit more general.
Yes. So we're going to talk about sharp force injuries today. And a sharp force injury is an injury that's produced by a pointed object or an object with sharp edges, characterized by a relatively well-defined traumatic separation of tissues.
So there are four categories within sharp force injury. There are stab wounds, there are incised wounds, there are chop wounds, and there are therapeutic slash diagnostic wounds. And we're going to go through and talk about each of those categories in more detail. So to start with, I'm going to talk about stab wounds. And a stab wound is a sharp force injury where the depth of the wound in the body exceeds the length along the skin.
It's interesting. I always thought of it, the length is greater than the width. But I guess the depth is the same thing. So I guess I consider it as the width. The surface injury is having a width.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, it doesn't really matter.
Yep.
Same thing.
Either way, it's deeper than it is.
Wide.
Wide.
Yeah.
And stab wounds are usually homicidal in manner. And the mechanism of death is usually due to exsanguination or massive hemorrhage. And we usually can't, I mean, we can give an approximation, but you can't tell the exact length and depth. In that sense, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, that's just what I thought of it that
Which way. Is how they describe it in the book, though. But now that I'm reading it and you said that, I'm definitely like, yeah, it should be width.
Yeah, it's weird.
Anyway, so by looking at a stab wound on a body, we can usually approximate the width and the length of the weapon that was used based on the characteristics of the wound track, but for a lot of reasons we can't give the exact size of the weapon.
And there are a lot of situations in which we can't do either.
Yeah. So it's hard to tell the length of the
weapon
because it could not be inserted all of the way into the body, so the wound track would be shorter than the actual weapon itself, which would give you a wrong approximation. Or it could be plunged in with enough force to indent the soft tissue
overlying it.
And so then the wound track will be longer than the length of the weapon. And the width might be poorly approximated based on skin elasticity. So different parts of your body have different sort of tension. And then also depending on what the person being stabbed is doing in the moment, their skin could have different kind of tension and like the angle of the knife and all these other things.
And if the knife moves once it's in the body by either the person moving or the knife moving, like sideways, not in and out, but sideways.
Yeah, and that's one of the factors that plays a role in the appearance of the stab wound. So a stab wound can look different based on the nature of the instrument that is used. Like a serrated knife might look different than a non-serrated knife, but it might also not.
But yeah, but you often really can't tell.
And then the direction of the thrust and then the movement of the blade, as Jordan mentioned, like if it's twisted, it can cause a different sort of shaped wound on the outside. So it could look something like an L or something, depending on how the movement was. Also, movement of the victim can cause the appearance of the stab wound to look different, and then the state of the skin tension. And the depth that a stab wound needs to be to produce a fatal wound depends on the area that's being stabbed. So they had this really interesting chart in the textbook that I use for the majority of this, DeMaio, where they showed the distance from the skin to various organs, and it was this study that they had done with CT scans, and the liver is one of the closest organs to the skin, and your abdominal aorta, according to this chart, is one of the farthest. So I just thought that was an interesting little experiment they had.
So one of the interesting things that I saw was that the force that's needed to actually cause these wounds is really dependent on a few factors. So one, it's depending on how sharp the knife is. It's really dull, it can take a lot more force to come in. But once it's penetrated the skin, it can actually slide through pretty easily unless it hits bone or something. So even if it's super sharp, you might really not need that much force to get something in.
Yeah.
But if it's super dull, it might take a lot. And if you hit bone and you can keep going through bone, obviously there's a lot of force behind it.
Yeah. So there are, as Jordan mentioned, there are many factors that affect the force necessary to drive a weapon into somebody. So besides being sharp or dull, it also depends on the different types of tissues you might encounter. Like going through soft tissue or organs is easier than going through bone, but also clothing plays a role. And so if somebody's wearing like a cotton t-shirt versus a leather jacket, how much force needed to get through to the skin varies. And the one thing I forgot to mention when I was talking about how the wound looks like on the outside, it also depends on how far the weapon is driven into the person, because there are different parts to a knife. So if a knife is being used to stab somebody and it's plunged into somebody up to the part of the knife called the guard, and so that's that piece that's between the blade and the handle that's there to protect the wielder of the weapon, the correlate is the hilt in swords, then it can leave an imprint on the skin, so a sort of patterned bruise.
What I thought was interesting in this book, it distinctly was like, it's called the knife guard and not the hilt.
Yeah.
But like, this is about just generic incised wound, or sorry, generic sharp force injuries.
Yeah.
A sword can be used too, so it's really the guard or the hilt.
Right.
Because if it's a knife, it's a guard. And obviously people don't die from sword all that much anymore. Yeah. But it easily could be the hilt if they're stabbed with a sword.
Yep.
So it was interesting that they were like, it's definitely not the hilt. It's like, it could be the hilt. What if they were stabbed with a sword?
Yeah.
Anything could happen.
The other part of the knife that they mentioned specifically was something called the ricasso, which I did not know was a thing. It's the part of the blade that's near the guard that is rectangular. It's kind of
farthest from the pointy end.
Yeah. And so if the stab wound goes in all the way...
If the blade goes all the way into the stab
wound. That
is what I'm
trying to say. If the blade goes in all the way up to the ricasso, then you won't get... you'll get a different looking wound. So it'll look rectangular.
So the only other thing that I saw with shape was... So we talked about how the width and the depth are related to, but not exactly the knife's width and length.
Yeah.
But then the shape of the wound in the skin itself, Nicole mentioned it has to do with like sometimes the tension and the composition of the skin. I thought it was really interesting. We have these elastic fibers in your skin that are all running in parallel, and they kind of go in different directions in different parts of the skin, but in one local area, they all run parallel to each other, and they're called Langer lines. Now, if where there's running parallel, you stab somebody and it goes in line, so it's parallel with those Langer lines, they're just elastic fibers, then the stab wound will maintain its shape. But if then you go perpendicular to it, essentially those elastic fibers will pull the tissue out and you end up with this more gaping stab wound. So even on like the same area of the skin, if you're stabbed in different directions and like just still perpendicular to the body, but kind of on a rotating around that, you can have different shaped stab wounds, and they can throw off the width of what you would calculate as the width of the blade. So you kind of have to reapproximate the skin back to what it would be in its relaxed state, because these elastic lines can throw it off. And I thought that was just really interesting that... Oh, and the other part of that I found cool, that I did know about this, but I didn't think of it in associative serum with this necessarily, is that plastic surgeons and surgeons try to use these lines to have better cuts and to leave less dramatic scars. If you go parallel to the lines, you'll have minimal scarring. If you go perpendicular to the lines, it is much more difficult to line them up and you can have more severe scarring. So it's something that, you know, affects us, but also affects live people doctors too.
Yeah. And speaking of multiple stab wounds, that's one of the ways you can help to get an approximate size of the weapon, mm-hmm. is by looking at all of the different wound tracks if somebody was stabbed multiple times with the same thing, and then come up with a range based on all of those different wound tracks. So in this chapter of the book, the thing they talk about the most are knives, because they're one of the most commonly used weapons to cause stab wounds, at least in the U.S. I don't know about the rest of the world. I didn't look up the epidemiology of this. That might be interesting. So anyway, they also talk a little bit about non-knives. So one of the things they talk about were ice picks, which they said are very uncommonly used in the U.S., but it can cause a lot of trouble at autopsy because the wounds from ice picks can resemble bullet wounds, or they can also be in areas that are difficult to find. So they can be relatively easily missed if you're not looking carefully for them. Another weapon that they talked about were barbecue forks.
Yeah.
So they said that...
Forks of all kinds, for that matter.
Yes. One of the quotes that I really liked in this chapter was... Perforation of the skin with a kitchen fork is generally not possible. The authors have seen only one death due to a stab wound with a kitchen fork, though they have seen numerous attempts. I love that. Like, but people have tried.
People try everything. People will try anything and everything. If they're desperate enough, and that's all the only thing you have at hand. The patterns are really important. So like with forks, you can obviously line it up with that fork. And there's a lot of different weapons that you, again, not everything, like a serrated knife, you might not be able to match that up with something necessarily. But there's a lot of patterned weapons that you can then match said wound up with the weapon.
Yeah, the barbecue fork was one that they mentioned because it'll cause clusters of 2 to 3 stab wounds that are next to each other. And then with kitchen forks, since they aren't really good at penetrating the skin, they cause abrasions or superficial penetrating wounds. And you can line the prongs up. And then screwdrivers were another one that they talked about that'll cause this round wound with 4 equally spaced cuts. So that's kind of a unique pattern. And then scissors can also cause a unique pattern depending on whether they're open or closed, because they can cause these wounds that are kind of near each other because there's only so far apart that the scissors can get and still be used as a stabbing weapon. Sorry, I wanted to say stabby stab stab.
You should have said stabby stab stab. Well,
now I did, so it's there. They also mentioned pens, pencils, broken pool cues, swords and lances, which are virtually unheard of in the U.S., and then arrows, which yes, are rare but not unheard of.
Accident, quote unquote, hunting accident.
Yep. And then they also mentioned impaling injuries, which are uncommon and usually secondary to falls or traffic accidents. When I was reading the bit about impaling, for some reason that's one of those visual things that makes me go, ugh.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and there aren't that many. You know, I'm interested in forensic pathology, but impaling is always, it's just so classic in movies, you know, where you somebody off the building and they fall onto rubble. Or in that Grey's Anatomy episode where there's that big subway accident, yes, and those two people get impaled with one thing and then they have to decide who's gonna live. It's just such a visual thing.
Yeah. The other thing about these that I find interesting is unless there's a bit of the weapon broken off in the bone, like you stab and you have the knife tip stuck in the bone, there's no way to distinctly match up the weapon with the injuries.
Yeah.
Unless the weapon is still in the body, mm-hmm, I guess. You know, there's the rare circumstance, but, you know, if you're testifying and they hold up some weapon, like, is this the murder weapon? The most you can say is it could be. Like I said, unless there's a piece of knife left behind, but realistically, there is no, it's not like a bullet, right? It's not like you can find the bullet and you can find the gun, and these definitely came from the same thing because the lands and grooves are the same.
And even then, you wouldn't, as a forensic pathologist, you wouldn't be the one that's like, yes,
sure, there's
people
who, but there is nobody who can take, I mean, I guess there's different ways, like there's blood on it, but like.
Yeah, that's one of those things that's on TV shows where they're like, yes, that is the murder weapon. And you're like, yeah, okay.
Yeah. Some of the stuff I thought was interesting was for stab wounds with suicides, there are often hesitation marks. And this goes for everything, but you can kill yourself by stabbing yourself. And those often have hesitation marks. And then they kind of went into a lot of detail on homicides and where injuries were associated with death and how death actually occurs. And I thought that was really interesting. So like, if you stab somebody in the chest, usually it's due to rapid exsanguination. On the right side, still most of the death has to do with, if like on the right chest, if you stab somebody in the right chest, it still mainly has to do with stabbing the heart. So part of the heart extends into the right half of your chest. And your aorta, the big vessel that feeds your body, goes down the center. So you can still hit that. And then on the left side, of course, there's plenty of heart there too. But even if you hit the lungs, it's harder to kill somebody just hitting the lungs. You can do it, and you can definitely fill up the area around the lungs with blood, or you can pierce the thorax in a certain way that air fills up around your... We talked about this last week with it called a pneumothorax. Yeah. There's air around your lungs rather than in it. And air around your lungs is really bad because it compresses your lungs and you can't inhale and get oxygen. I just breathed in, which I realize you guys probably couldn't hear. And
actually, this microphone is so good, I bet they did hear it.
Yes.
So it's just a nice...
You're welcome.
Emphasis on that, showing off how well you can breathe.
So good at breathing, guys. I thought it was interesting that it only takes 150 mils of blood, milliliters of blood in the pericardial sac, so in the sac around your heart, that can cut off proper beating of your heart and refilling of your heart to cause what's called cardiac tamponade. And then things that I didn't think about is if you injure the atria, which are the tinier sacs on top of the heart, and the aorta, they are going to cause bigger injuries than if you stab the ventricles, which are the big, muscly bottom parts that beat the blood into either your lungs or the rest of your body. And that's because when the ventricles contract, they can actually kind of cut off and tamponade that cut. Versus the atria and the aorta don't have muscle. Oh. So you can't really cut off the bleeding from those. So I just thought it was really interesting.
Yeah, that's definitely the opposite of what I would think. Well, I mean, if I...
thought about it enough.
Right. I guess it would make sense. Although, I would still think the aorta would be the fastest if you stabbed.
Oh, yeah. So this just lumped the two together.
No, I know. Yeah.
But no,
but the atria, for sure. I would be like, no, if you hit the ventricle, it's going to...
Yeah, because there's more blood. It's like, no, it's the same amount of blood.
Yeah.
It's just in a floppier part of the heart. And then, of course, the abdomen. If you stab your abdomen, your liver is very vascular. So if you stab that, you can bleed out. But the rest of your abdomen, you actually do a pretty good job surviving. A lot of those people make it to the hospital versus, you know, if you stab somebody in the heart, they're going to die pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And they talked about this. I found really interesting. A brain stab through the eye or temporal region can happen with a knife.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Which if you think about, your skull's pretty good. It's going to stop most stuff, but through the eyeball, it's not bad. And around your temples and kind of like the bottom area, that's a weaker part of your bone. And they said that death from these is actually not from it can be either from intracranial bleeding, so bleeding in the brain, or meningitis, which is a bacterial infection. So that's a secondary thing. And they say, as a rule, a single stab wound of the skull and brain are not immediately fatal, and the victim may walk or run from the assailant. Which is crazy. And the only way that people see it, apparently, is a skull defect at autopsy. So not even necessarily the skin, which can kind of close itself back up. Mm-hmm. But when you go to take out the brain, you can see a skull defect at that time, which I thought was crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, when I read that, I didn't realize it was that common. Because you hear those stories of, like, people accidentally falling and stabbing themselves through the roof of the mouth. Mm-hmm. Or, like, that guy who had major personality changes after he was in a work accident and got this, like... big pipe. So you hear stories like that, but you always think that's the exception, not the rule.
Yeah. But it's crazy. Your brain is pretty impressive. It's a pretty impressive organ.
Yep. Good job, brain.
Thanks. Yeah, right? And then other stab wounds that people can sometimes survive and think they're doing okay and then die is stabbings in your extremities. You have some pretty big vessels going through them. And the biggest one is in your leg called the femoral artery. And people might not realize how bad it is and try to walk away, and then they could die from exsanguination shortly thereafter. But they could get, you know, they might be able to get a distance away from the assailant. They mentioned harikari.
Yeah.
Which is suicide involving an abdominal stab wound. That's that Japanese tradition, right?
Yeah, it's traditionally associated with samurai.
Yeah. And that's where you have sudden evisceration of the internal organs. So that, I guess I never realized before how and why you die from it and why you die suddenly. You have this decrease in pressure, and so you have all of a sudden less blood returning to your heart, and then you have what's called sudden cardiac collapse because you don't have enough blood returning, it's not pumping blood out, and you die suddenly from that.
Yeah, I hadn't realized that doing that, they were trying to go for instant death. I always thought it was like this very dramatic... you cut open your abdomen and it's just a slow, terrible, lengthy, bleeding out type of thing.
It's exactly what I used to think too. But it was interesting. And then the only other thing I wanted to mention, which I'll get into a little bit later with therapeutic wounds, if you have a stab wound and the person survives to make it to the hospital, they try to treat you, and then you die, that person still goes to the medical examiner. Now, if I get stabbed on the side of my chest and my lungs starts to collapse, so they need to put in what's called a chest tube. They're getting away from it now. Surgeons are more aware of this, but in the past, they've gone through that cut already to put in a chest tube and then a wound that might help identify an assailant or a weapon or whatever is now being used for a medical purpose, so it might be altered. So getting somebody back with stab wounds that have gone to the hospital and have had treatments, and we'll talk about that more later, can throw things off. And I feel like it's bigger in stab than in sized wounds that I have seen these anyway. Because I feel like I've seen a bunch of these at the Emmys. Like,
oh, I dude have was. Not.
Oh, really? Uh-uh. There were fewer. I had people that were stabbed multiple times in the chest. They went to ED, usually SFGH, who, you know, would do a thoracotomy. And there was even one when we got the guy's heart out and there were staples in the heart because he had got the guy's ventricle.
Oh, wow.
They had made it to the hospital. They had gone in. They had stapled the ventricle. What they didn't realize was behind the heart in the descending aorta, that was actually cut too. And they hadn't seen that the aorta was sliced and that was just exsanguinating him.
No.
So they got part of it. But as we said, the ventricle can kind of tampon out itself.
Yeah.
But they needed to get the aorta, which cannot do that so well.
Yay.
But it was... because that's a deep stab wound to go from the chest, through the chest wall, through the heart, into the aorta behind it.
Right.
It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, gee.
And so the next category of wounds are incised wounds. So we said the other ones were deeper than they were wide. Incised wounds are just the opposite. They are wider than they are deep. These are also usually have sharp edges without associated abrasions or contusions, so scrapes or bruises. They can, but they often don't. These are less commonly fatal, and they're often seen in the emergency department, but obviously they can be. They're often on exposed skin, so whereas you can stab somebody through clothes, it's less common to have a cutting wound through clothes. Fatal ones are usually on the arms and the neck, and often the suicidal and homicidal ones involve the neck as the place where the incised wound happened. In contrast to stab wounds, these are really not helpful in identifying the weapon. And in contrast to lacerations, which we talked about before a little bit, so a laceration is a similar, it kind of looks like a cut on the surface, but it's caused by blunt force. So you get hit with a hammer and you can end up with a quote-unquote cut from that, but it's not caused by a blade, it's caused by a blunt force. And the difference is these incised wounds have very clean edges, and you can kind of easily lay them back together, versus a laceration is more jagged and it's harder to match back up.
Yeah.
And there's these things called tissue bridges. Usually incised wounds kind of, you can imagine this, they start really superficial, then they go deeper, and then they get superficial again. So that's one of the easier ways to tell what an incised wound is going to be. And we talked about the Langer lines, those elastic fibers. They also can change the shape of the wound based on if you're parallel or perpendicular to those. Specifically in suicides, they often expose areas of the body before cutting. So in a homicide, they might slash out at an arm, and through the clothes, you might get a cut on the arm. Versus in a suicide, they'll often pull their sleeve back before they cut. And then, as we said with homicides, with stab wounds and suicides, you get hesitation marks often in suicides. And kind of the stereotypical movie version of the little hesitation marks on the inside of your wrists. And they can be in your wrists, they can be in your legs, they can be in a lot of places, but those are typically associated with suicides.
And that's different than, like, if somebody is cutting themselves.
So I'm just gonna read this because it's obviously wrong. I don't know what I meant. Fatal incised wounds of the arm are almost always fatal.
No, I mean, it's right.
I think I meant that incised wounds of the arm are almost always fatal.
Oh.
But that's probably not right either. What? I'm really confused.
You're right, that's not true because they would be always fatal.
They would be always fatal. Fatal incised wounds of the arms are almost always suicidal. That makes more sense.
Yes.
Yes, that does make sense. And then, understandably, if you're right-handed, you often cut on your left arm and vice versa. Interestingly, when you look at incise wounds, cuts that are on the flexor, which is the kind of like the inside of your elbow surface, and on the radial aspect, which is the thumb side, are almost always suicidal. And then ones are on the extensor surfaces, so that's like the back of your elbow, and on the pinky side of your arm are almost always defensive. And you can imagine that if you put your arm up to block somebody, you're more regulated and get the back of your arm and then the pinky side. Mm-hmm. Versus if you're going to cut, you can imagine you would get more your thumb side and the inside of your arms. So then I'm going to talk about neck wounds briefly. So you can get accidental neck wounds, and this can be if you, you know, jump or fall through glass, or you have a projectile that kind of sprays and you get a lot of cuts around the neck. So homicidal neck wounds, you can either have them from the assailant being behind or the assailant being in front. And you can imagine in the back, they start on the opposite side of whatever hand they're using, up by the ear. That goes down across the center of your neck and then back up towards the other ear. But it doesn't quite get as high. So it's kind of a standard pattern that we see when somebody gets cut from behind. Versus if somebody gets cut from the front, it'll usually be short and angled cuts that are usually in swipes, and they'll usually be multiple. So homicides from behind are one solid swoop, and from the front could be multiple like slashes. And then a suicidal one looks more like a homicidal one from behind, where you kind of start up from one ear and across to the other ear. And the way you die from these kind of injuries are a combination of exsanguination and air embolus. And air embolus is when you get air into your bloodstream, and that causes a lot of issues later down the pipe, for lack of a better word. They also said that suicide could be accompanied by cadaveric spasm, which we've talked about before, but you cut yourself and then you clench that knife really hard. Cadaveric spasm is a debated topic, but maybe you'll find a knife clenched in the hand. Then two things that cover both stabbing and incised wounds. If somebody's in the water, it may alter what these wounds look like. So obviously if something is pre-mortem, happened before they died, there's going to be blood in the wound. But if they've been in water for a long time, you might not have that anymore. So you can look in the surrounding tissue and see if there's bleeding in the tissue around it to suggest that this injury happened before death. And then finally, I had to always make sure you examine the clothing that overlies any of these injuries to see if it matches up. And then I'll talk about a different story later, but one case I had, we talked about stabbing and cutting wounds. I had one case in San Francisco where it was a murder-suicide. The murderer was the mentally ill sister of the murdered person, and she had actually... it covers a lot of the topics. She had gotten scissors and she stabbed her sister multiple times in the neck and chest. You categorize wounds usually with letters, A, B, C, blah, blah, blah. And they went A through like A, H or something. So they went through the whole alphabet once and then again.
Wow.
And I think the final injury on the one that was murdered was, maybe it was a stab wound that went through into the trachea.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the suicidal person, interestingly, she had the same array of injuries.
Oh.
And it's very rare for somebody to be able to stab yourself that many times. So there were definitely some things that looked more like hesitation marks. There were some things that looked more like that were incised wounds, some things that were more stab wounds. But it was all the way down from the neck through the chest. And I think that she got herself in the heart on one of the suicidal ones that we thought was the... I can't remember exactly. Sometimes it's the same weapon used for multiple decedents. And in this case, it was unfortunately a mentally ill sister who her mentally healthy sister was taking care of her, but just had a suicidal break. And one was like lying in bed next to the other. It's one of the ones I went to a scene on. Yeah. There's a lot to document in these. And when you do an autopsy, it's really important to line up these wounds from what you see in the clothing, what you see on the skin, and then kind of what the tract is. So it goes from, you know, the stab wound went from the skin through the ribs, through part of the lung and hit the heart, went through the heart and hit the aorta. And you can get that one full tract from this one wound. And you kind of, when you're doing the autopsy, and you have one or two cuts, sorry, one or two stabs, it's pretty easy to track them. But when you have like A through AH stab wounds,
yeah,
it was, you know, a logistical nightmare trying to follow all of them and see what all of them hit. And I think they were kind of grouped together.
Yep. The only other thing from incised wounds that I wanted to mention was you kind of spoke about how things like glass can also cause incised wounds. And they specifically talked a lot about people who put their hand or fist through windows, particularly intoxicated persons. And from watching like movies, you don't imagine that jumping through a window or putting a body part through a glass window is going to cause enough damage to kill you, but it definitely can. It happens a lot. So just wanted to mention that one in particular. So now I'm going to move on to chop wounds. And chop wounds are those that are produced by heavy instruments that have a cutting edge. So things like axes, machetes, and meat cleavers. And instead of just a sharp force or cutting injury, it's a combination of sharp and blunt force injury. So you usually see an incised wound, and then underlying that wound, there's a fracture or some sort of deep groove in any bones, and that can kind of point that this is a chopping weapon that was used. And besides those three things that I mentioned, one of the ones that they talked about were boat and airplane propellers. Mm-hmm. And particularly for boat propellers, that's where the thing about how the wound characteristics change when somebody's been in water.
Yep.
So sometimes it can be hard to tell if, like, this was a dead body that was in water and then got run over by a boat versus somebody who got... Sorry, yeah.
No, sorry, run over by a boat seems weird, but yes, it's true.
Versus somebody who was killed by a boat, like, their wounds were pre-mortem.
By some other chop wound and then put into the water, so you're like, oh, all these chop wounds must be a boat propeller.
Right. Yeah, because all of the blood can kind of be pulled out of those wound tracks. That's just one special thing in particular I thought was cool. Interesting.
And then the last category we have is therapeutic and diagnostic wounds. So I talked about these a little bit, but these are produced by medical personnel in a resuscitation attempt. So these can be a chest tube, they can be drains, it can be a thoracotomy, which is where you essentially take off the rib cage to try to get underneath it to save their lives. A laparotomy, which is a when you cut open the abdomen rather than the chest to try to get in there and stop bleeding. And the issue with some of this, and like I said, people are trained to avoid these now, but the homicidal wound may be used for a tube. It may be extended in surgery to cut the patient less than they've already been cut. But it's not necessarily the best thing if you want to follow this up later on. So it's really important when you're a medical examiner doing this autopsy to know exactly what the surgeons have done and what they saw before they did the surgery or a procedure and what they did during surgery and what they tried to fix versus what they didn't try to fix. So the case I mentioned before where the guy was stabbed and they had staples in the ventricle, but they didn't do anything in the aorta, they hadn't mentioned the aorta at all in their notes.
Oh.
So it could be that at that point they were, you know, couldn't resuscitate them because they had lost too much blood, or there could have been some other issue, but they hadn't mentioned the aorta. So between several factors, we surmised that that was the end of the stab wound tract because they hadn't physically cut the aorta, which granted, they hopefully wouldn't do anyway, but it was taken into account. Pretty much point with all of this is read the chart, know exactly what they did, and bring in all the data together to come up with the appropriate conclusion.
I don't have a particular story, but I'm just going to talk about something that it just crossed my mind as being a sharp force type of injury, and it's death by icicle.
Oh, that would be really difficult.
Yeah, because it's one of those classic brain teasers, right? Where it's like,
yeah. But there's a puddle of water next to him. How did he die?
Yeah. Falling icicle. So I found a couple articles. Some of them have short stories, like little blurbs about people who were killed by icicles. And then one is this article in the Telegraph from 2010. And apparently it was a record year in Russia for people being killed by icicles.
I love that there's a record.
I know. Well, I guess it was a record at that point during the winter that there had been a record number of injured and fatalities, but like every year it says that dozens of Russians get killed by falling icicles.
That's dozens too many.
I know. So at this point, when the article came out, there were 150 people who had been injured and 5 who were dead. And it was pretty early on, so it seems like they were only expecting those numbers to grow. But one of the injured was a 6-month-old baby who a chunk of ice dropped on her pram.
Don't leave your children out in the freezing cold. Yeah. That should be like the given.
Yeah.
There are moose out there.
There are moose and icicles. And then another one was an 8-year-old boy, and he suffered serious spinal damage after an icicle struck his back. Yep. And yeah, one of the points that the city's governor was making in this article, Valentina Matveyenko.
Yeah, you're going to have some fun names in my story that I can't pronounce.
Yep. She had apparently fired 11 officials accused of doing too little to keep the city streets and rooftops free of snow and ice.
I guess that's who you would blame. But what about, like,
the building owners?
Like, your personal house at home.
Yes. That what was one of the stories that I found in 1994, this is in Chicago, this man named Donald Booth was waiting for a cab on Michigan Avenue when a hunk of ice the size of a microwave landed on his head, crushing his skull and spinal column.
That's a lot of ice.
And he passed away. And his family later received $4.5 million in a lawsuit against Neiman Marcus and the tenant of the building from which the ice came. Huh. So I guess they do... The building owners do take responsibility, but also, like, what about public buildings? Then there must be some sort of plan in place in locations that have icicles as a known problem.
So I've lived in New England my entire life before moving out here, and I feel like that's not something that is ever, I mean, at my house in Connecticut, we would always, like, clear the icicles off when they got too big because it would weigh down, like, the gutters, but... Because they get impaled by an icicle. And that's gotta be sharp too, right? Because like a chunk of ice is one thing, but like I feel like we talked about how you need more force when something's dull. Icicles aren't that, I mean, they're pointier than some things, but like usually it's a kind of rounded edge where like the drop of water has started to almost but didn't fall.
Yeah. I guess the majority of these stories, it actually does look like it's more of a blunt force injury. Rather than
stabby stab,
the stabby stab that we imagine when we're talking about icicles falling.
But I would imagine it definitely has happened.
Yeah.
But like, it's got to be like just right, right? Because usually if you're under an icicle, you're going to be standing up. So it's going to hit the top of your head, not like a soft tissue thing that it'll easily be able to cut through.
Yeah. Actually, there's this story from Cassopolis, Michigan in 1903.
There you go.
A police officer was killed when a huge icicle, which fell upon him and cut off the top of his head.
Cut off the top of his head?
Yeah. So I don't know what he was doing. Maybe he was bending over and it fell on his neck or something?
That's strange.
I have no idea.
But it was the top of his head. It wasn't his head. It was just the top of his head.
That is, yeah, that's weird. I want to know more about this story.
I do too.
From 1903, which probably doesn't have great documentation.
What? No.
I doubt it. Although it looks like that story was in Chicago, so maybe I'd be able to find something somewhere.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Huh.
The last little blurb that I wanted to say was there was a boy in Devonshire, England in 1776 who was killed by an icicle, and his epitaph, the little poem on his gravestone, reads, "Bless my," whatever his name was, "here he lies in a sad pickle killed by an icicle."
I guess if you need something that rhymes. Pickle and icicle? I guess.
Icicle. So I guess it's in a sad pickle killed by an icicle. You know?
What rhymes with icicle? Bicycle?
Can no longer ride his bicycle killed by an icicle.
There you go. That's what I should have put. Although, did they have bicycles in 1776?
That's a great question. I would think that they did.
Okay.
Right? Isn't that when they had the old-timey big one with the little
one? With
the
big wheel and the little wheel. Maybe.
Oh. Clearly, I'm in the wrong profession. I should be writing epitaphs.
Well, now you know if something happens, you can always fall back on your epitaph writing.
That is true.
So we're going to actually use this as a jumping off point. We're going to time travel a little bit to the late 1800s, early 1900s. This story that I'm going to say, I actually got because I read this book somewhat recently called Hotel... I can never tell if it was a Satcher or Sachet, but it's S-A-C-H-E-R. So I said Hotel Sacher just because it was easier in my brain.
Yeah.
By Radhika Donert. And this was a story that was based in Vienna in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And they kept mentioning the Empress of Austria because in this time, the countries as we know them now didn't exactly have the same boundaries. And a lot of places had kings, queens, empresses, whatever, still ruling. So in Austria, there was an empress. And in Hungary, there was a queen. And this was in a big time of upheaval. And at some point in this story, this empress had been killed and everybody went into mourning. So obviously being me, I went into look how she died.
Yeah.
And it was actually a really interesting story. So Elizabeth of Bavaria, her nickname was Cece. She was born December 24th, 1837. She was born into the Royal Bavarian House of Wittelsbach. Just amazing names.
Love it.
And she married Emperor Franz Joseph I, who was the Emperor of Austria at the time. So she was the Empress of Austria, which is how she regularly got mentioned in this. And then partially through her kinship with Hungary, she helped bring about the dual monarchy of Austria and Hungary. So when she died, she was the Empress of Austria and the Queen of Hungary.
I'm the Queen of Hungary.
You just ate half a calzone.
I didn't eat the whole half. I'm actually not hungry. I just wanted to make that joke. Continue your sad story of death. I'm sorry.
In 1898, she traveled incognito, which I think is really interesting at the time because there's less of the social, obviously no social media, but like there isn't this whole, there's like the cult following at the time was after like the royals and stuff like this. And it was easier to go incognito and under an assumed name and that kind of thing.
I think about that stuff all the time. Like how back in the day, if you were a king, like how is anybody supposed to know what you look like?
Yeah, unless you're part of the royalty and they see you at court.
Right.
Because the pictures that they paint of you are not the most, I mean, they're not bad, but they're not the most accurate.
And it's not like those get widely distributed to your the peasants that are like in the outer regions of the country.
Yeah, so it's interesting.
Yeah.
But thanks, social media. So she traveled incognito to Geneva, Switzerland, despite several warnings of possible assassination attempts. So Saturday, September 10th, 1898 sets our stage. Somebody at the hotel that she was staying at, called the Hotel Beau Rivage, revealed who she was to the... And they didn't know that she was revealed, but behind the scenes, people knew, had gotten out who she, that she was there.
Boo.
Incognito.
Boo.
At 1:35 p.m., Elizabeth and her lady-in-waiting, here comes horrible name pronunciation number one, Irma Stazzeri de Stara et Nagy Mihaly.
That was her maid?
That's her lady-in-waiting.
Lady-in-waiting.
Is a countess. They both left the hotel to catch the steamship Geneve for Montreux. And the Empress apparently insisted that they walk without the other members of her entourage because they, I think, between trying to keep it still quiet, and if there's a big group of people, it must be something important. So I don't know the whole details of that, but she insisted that her and her lady-in-waiting walk to the steamboat, steamship. So they're walking along the promenade when this man approached them and kind of attempted to peer under the Empress's parasol, and then he stumbled and made this movement with his hand as if to regain his balance. At this time, the Empress collapsed, and a coach driver helped her to her feet. Then the two women walked about 100 yards, so about a football field, to the gangway of the ship that they were going to leave on, and they boarded. The second they got to the ship, the Empress lost consciousness and collapsed. A doctor was called for, but there was only a nurse available. And by the time some of this like started to get underway, the boat was already sailing out of the harbor. Three men carried her to the top deck, and Stare, the lady-in-waiting, opened her dress and cut Elizabeth's corset so she could breathe easier. She apparently revived somewhat, and Stare said, asked if she was in pain, to which she replied no, and what has happened before losing consciousness again.
Oh no.
At this point, Stare noticed a small brown stain above the Empress's breastbone, and at this point, since she hadn't regained consciousness, Stare informed the captain of her identity, because like I said, she was all hidden, and they turn the ship around. And this is like a, I think I looked it up, it's a 63-meter long boat. So it's a pretty big steamship. And so they turn the ship around, brought her back to the hotel. And at the hotel director's wife, Fanny Mayer, a visiting nurse, and Stare removed her clothes and saw a few drops of blood and a small wound. When they moved her from the stretcher to the bed, they realized that she was dead. And at 2:10 p.m., she was pronounced. So this all started at 1:35. She left the hotel, and by 2:10, she was dead.
This is why you never go outside.
And she was the Empress of Austria for 44 years. At the time, the longest standing empress.
Wow.
So this man, he fled down the Rue des Alpes and threw the weapon away. He was caught by two cab drivers and a sailor. And secured by the gendarme, which I didn't know what gendarme were, but those are apparently what armed French police officers are called, gendarme.
Mm.
At autopsy, they found that a weapon had penetrated 3.3 inches, so a good chunk, into her thorax, fractured her fourth rib, pierced the lung and pericardium, and penetrated the heart from the top before coming out of the base, which is the base of the heart is actually still on the top. But the base of the left ventricle, so the top part of the left ventricle.
He did all that with his
one stab.
Clumsy.
The clumsy stumble. Wow. And he looked like he was reaching out and stabbed.
Jeez.
And there was like a few drops of blood, not much, so nobody really knew how bad it was. They realized that the weapon was very thin and very narrow. And this is what really made me want to do this story. Due to the extremely tight corset, they think that actually helped staunch some of the blood flow.
Oh.
And it kept the blood from going into the pericardial sac from like a gush to like drops. So like every heartbeat, there was another drop. Because remember, she walked 100 yards.
Right.
I mean, it didn't like with help, but she made it 100 yards conscious before she got to the boat.
Yeah, yeah.
And then she regained consciousness when they opened it, which I'm assuming was because her lungs were able to fill momentarily, but then her pericardial sac, the sac around her heart, filled with blood, and then her heart wasn't able to beat, and that's why she eventually passed.
Wow.
And, yeah. So it was just really interesting because you think about other factors contributing to death and that kind of thing. And the speed of death. And one of the things I never thought about was a corset really staunching the blood flow.
Yeah. So we should start wearing corsets again, is what you're saying.
Or just don't be in the public eye as much as a empress of Austria or queen of Hungary. Oh, well. Don't have two whole countries under your reign or under your husband's reign.
I think I do not have to worry about that. I think I'm safe.
So she was placed in a triple coffin, which I thought was interesting. Two inner ones of lead and one outer one of bronze.
But why?
Just she's a queen and an empress and they have a lot of money.
But why?
So we're going to go on to the attacker now.
Okay.
And explain some of that. So the attacker is this guy, Luigi Lucchini, who is a 25-year-old Italian anarchist. He was in Geneva because he planned to kill the Duke of Orleans, who at the time was the pretender to the throne of France, which I didn't know what pretender meant, but it's the claimant. He wasn't actually ruling the country, but his grandfather was the last king of France before the revolutionaries took it over.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was still like claiming the throne, but apparently it's called the pretender to the throne, which I thought was interesting. They found out that after failing to find the Duke of Orleans, because he had left earlier in the day, I believe, that this guy just wanted to kill a sovereign. And he selected Elizabeth when a Geneva newspaper revealed that she was in town.
Wow.
So this had gotten, apparently had gotten out to the newspapers.
Yeah.
And a quote from him was, "I am an anarchist by conviction. I came to Geneva to kill a sovereign with object of giving an example to those who suffer and those who do nothing to improve their social position. It did not matter to me who the sovereign was whom I should kill. It was not a woman I struck, but an empress. It was a crown that I had in view." And this was, besides the fact that he's obviously a little bit crazy, Elizabeth was actually known for preferring the common man to courtiers. She was known for her charitable work, and she was actually considered a blameless target. And because of this, his sanity was questioned, because of all the people, if you're going for the common man and, you know, not in killing somebody who's only doing what they do to improve their social position, she is the wrong person.
Right.
She was born into it, sure, but she was doing a lot to help this thing, to help the common person. He was declared sane, tried as a common murderer, not a political criminal, and was incarcerated for life. They tried to get him to have the death penalty, but that wasn't a thing that was allowed in France at this time. They found the weapon the next day. He had thrown it away when he was running. So what he actually stabbed her with was a sharpened needle file that was about 4 inches long, and it's actually used to file the eyes of industrial needles.
Oh.
So, like, needles, like, that have clothes, obviously they have the eye of the needle. Yeah. It's used to file those needles down.
Huh.
So it's this essentially long, like, metal toothpick is how I think of it, that was inserted into a wooden handle. And so when he stabbed her with it, it's kind of like a thin ice pick, right? Yeah, we talked about ice pick injuries, mm-hmm. where it made this really tiny hole. The skin probably covered it up pretty well.
Right.
They saw this tiny wound and a few drops of blood, but yeah. it can see, just like, you know, the stab wound to the brain, it seals itself off
yeah.
surprisingly well if it's small enough. And they had mentioned in here that if it was left in there, it might have plugged up the bleeding a little bit more, but still, like, she was able to survive for a little bit for several things, one being the thinness of the weapon, mm-hmm. and two, the corset, which is the only time that corsets have ever helped anybody in the history of the world.
I mean, I guess it depends on what your goals are.
It's true.
If you want to artificially modify your waist, they definitely help some people do that.
Yeah, but then they gave them all kind of medical problems.
But they're achieving their life's dream.
Of being a fake Instagram model before they had Photoshopping.
Yeah.
So they weren't sure if he acted alone, which he insisted he did, or if it was part of a greater political plot. He attempted to kill himself with a sharpened key from a tin of sardines.
He just really likes stabbing.
A tin of sardines. Like, yeah. The key. Like, that's on February 20th, 1900. And then 10 years later, he died after hanging himself on October 16th, 1910, after a guard confiscated and destroyed his complete memoirs. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
This guy was a little bit extra. This guy
sounds like a work. A piece of work.
Yeah. This is 1900s extra.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, I thought it was, honestly, I kind of wanted to do sharp force injuries so I could tell the story.
Now the truth comes out.
Because I just think it's fascinating that you can, a lot of things, right? The whole kill the, like, assassination attempts have been a thing for a long time. But the access you used to have to people, because, like, you would never be able to get that close to a president or prime minister of any country nowadays that easily as a common person, right?
Right.
You would have to find some other way and not get through a bunch of security to get in. And then the corsets are just their own crazy thing. And then, yeah, it was just a weird case. It was interesting.
There's a lot of stuff in that case. That was cool. Yeah. I like how you got sidetracked from your for fun reading book by going into something that's more related to work.
Welcome to my life. There's so many times now, like, I tend to read a lot of crime dramas and that kind of thing. And it's like, oh, could they actually die that way? The one that I just finished the other day was, you know, somebody getting shot point blank in the head. I was like, okay, that one I'll give you.
Yeah.
That's one way to do it. That works.
Don't even
well.
Have to look that one up.
Yeah. Nope.
That's a thing. So if you liked what you heard on this episode or any of our other episodes, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast. It's how we get boosted up and other people can hear about us.
You can visit our website at deadmendotellpodcast.com, where we link to all of our sources and our episode guide.
On Twitter, we're at deadmendo.
At Insta, we're at the Dead Tell Tales.
We have a Facebook page, Dead Men Do Tell Tales Podcast.
And as always, you can send us an email with comments, suggestions, or questions at thedeadtelltales@gmail.com.
And our opening music is Introducing the Pre-Roll by Lee Rosevear, who you can find on SoundCloud.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Thanks.
Hope you enjoyed.
Bye.
Bye.